This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Nobody worries about kids listening to thousands, literally thousands of songs about heartbreak, rejection, pain, misery, and loss. Did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Or was I miserable because I listened to pop music?
Well, music is my life, man. What do you want me to do?
Welcome to another episode of Love That Album, the podcast where myself and a guest who I've got on for that week will be harping on about an album that means a lot to us. This, well, technically is episode number 3, although it's sort of more like episode 2. For those of you who might have been following the blog, might have sort of worked out that episode 2 I had some, shall we say, technical problems, and I ended up rubbing off the crucial part of the episode, which was myself and my good friend Jeff Smith talking about John Hiatt's fantastic album Meet the Family. So I just put up online what I had, but none of it was talking about the album, so I might have to come back to that album somewhere along the line, but never mind. Today is episode 3, and with me I have my good friend and Melbourne music journalist, Mr. Jeff Jenkins.
G'day, Mo. Thanks for having us back after our Bruce Springsteen battle.
Yes, had some good feedback about that. Other Bruce fans out there and felt that we actually had something to contribute to the milieu, shall we say, of Bruce Springsteen.
Well, we'll see how we go today.
So today, for those of you who are listening to this, and what am I saying that for? Of course you're listening to this. For those of you out there who are interested, we're doing the main focus of today's episode will be talking about the great album Get the Knack. Yes, you heard me say great album and Get the Knack in the same sentence. And unfortunately, both Jeff and I believe that this album has received something of a bum rap over the last 30 years. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on in the show in some depth. But before we do that, a nice way to start off the show would be let's talk about music that we've been listening to of late. Jeff, what's been on your turntable, CD player, MP3 player, any form of music reproduction?
Well, Mo, I'm a little bit hungover today. I had a big night seeing a Melbourne band last night, Skipping Girl Vinegar.
Oh, right.
And I love this band. I think this could be my album of the year. It's their second album. It's called Keep Calm, Carry the Monkey, which I think is a great title for an album. What I love about this band, apart from the songs, is their attention to detail. And their live performance is just remarkable. But with the albums, they're old school. It's all about the artwork. It's all about the look and the feel of the album. A lot of this album was paid for by their fans. They have these hobo fans who donated money to the band to make the record. It's sort of like the old school cottage industry.
There's a few bands who are sort of pursuing that line nowadays, I think.
Yeah, very much so, but I don't think very few of them do it as well as Skipping Girl Vinegar do it. You really feel that you're a part of it. It is a Skipping Girl Vinegar community. Love the songs. This record, a real treat on the album. Ron Sexsmith pops up singing on the closing track on the album. It's kind of a lot deeper and darker than their debut record. But certainly, yeah, one I really recommend to people to seek out, Melbourne band Skipping Girl Vinegar.
Anything else? What else has been on your...
Certainly The Fauves. I love The Fauves. I've just done a review of their new album, Japanese Engines. Now, I think it's their 10th album. And I call them the Dustin Fletcher of Australian music. And for people probably going, who the hell's Dustin Fletcher? I'm a huge Essendon supporter in the AFL. He's I think he's 36, nearly 37. he's just played and played and played, still consistently brilliant. Some of his contemporaries, well, most of them, they're all retired, but his contemporaries were more glamorous and got a lot more attention than Dustin Fletcher got. But he always gets a job done. And I think that's true with the Fives too. They are consistently brilliant. Been around, I think, 23 years now. Have a real wry take on the world and the music industry. Two great singers and songwriters, Andrew Cox and the guitarist Phil the Dr. Leonard, in fine form on this record. I don't think it's quite as good as their last record, but it's still very, very good. And it's sort of, there's two albums, Japanese Engines and German Engines. German Engines will follow early 2012. But there's, yeah, a very, very clever band.
Mm. Now, while we're talking about local bands, I wanted to ask you about, I haven't heard the album, and I'm embarrassed to say, but I noticed that there's been a classic album been released of the band The Hoxton Creepers. Now, growing up, I remember always hearing about The Hoxton Creepers, but why they particularly caught my attention just now with this re-release of this old album of theirs is because I saw in the lineup of the band was a musician I knew very well from another life, Mr. Paul Thomas, Weddings, Parties, Anything,
yes,
which
indeed.
Also recently had a reunion for their annual Grand Final Eve.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this Hoxton Creepers re-release. It's their debut album, 12 Days to Paris, which was co-produced by Steve Berlin from Los Lobos. Yes, he was in Australia at the time, and they got him to work on the record. It was one of those records, obviously an 80s record. A lot of 80s records, particularly in Australia, unless you had a mega, mega budget, they didn't sound that great. They just sounded a little bit flat. And also, they haven't dated that well. So that was sort of always my feeling with the Hoxton Creepers, an incredible live band. The singer, Rob Craw, should have been a superstar, just a remarkable front man. The entire band, all great. But it's one of those things that, you know, you talk to young people now and you tell them about a band and go, oh, the Hoxton Creepers. But you always felt, not embarrassed, but putting on the record never did the band justice.
Mm.
The great thing about this re-release is that it is remastered, which, you know, they remastered just about every re-release. Some of them work, some of them don't work. Some you can't even hear the difference. With this Hoxton Creepers record, you really can hear the difference.
Okay.
It's just given an extra oomph.
Mm.
Bit more muscle there, and the songs have always been great, so really, really excited about that. So if you want to check out a fine Australian band from the 80s, should have been much bigger than what they were, check out the Hoxton Creepers and this re-release.
Now I'm going to come back to once again to another local act which I believe received the remastering treatment in the last 12 months, I think, and the word got about that it was a vast improvement over the sound quality. I think it was Mark Gillespie.
Oh, yes, yes.
His
debut.
And the second one as well.
Yeah, has come out as well. Yeah, Aztec Music, a fine Melbourne label run by Gil Matthews, who was the drummer in Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs.
Mm.
Probably the smartest drummer, if not in world music, then in Australian music, because
Wally De Backer's not too far behind.
Well, that's true. But yeah, Gil Matthews, very, very clever businessman, but a music lover. And the Aztec Music re-releases, can recommend all of them, even if, you know, the music you might not love, the way it's put together, usually liner notes from Ian McFarlane, who wrote the Australian Rock and Roll Encyclopedia. They are just fantastic re-releases, including the Mark Gillespie ones.
Mm.
Great stuff.
Earlier on this year from Aztec Music, I bought, I think we discussed this in over email a few months back, was a Broderick Smith's Big Combo album. And it was a funny thing, I brought the CD home, was playing it, and my wife Joanne said to me, oh, is this a Bruce Springsteen album? And then I thought about that, you know, it really is
stuff
very
like Faded Roses.
Yes. There was definitely something to it, to that comment. So that's your list of albums for this week?
Yes, right. Certainly. Probably album of the year, Skipping Girl Vinegar, Look Out for the Fives, great re-release from the Hoxton Creepers, first time on CD, and which is very, very special.
Okay. All right, well, I'll go through a few albums that I've been listening to of late. Now, the new album for Wilco just came out, I think, maybe about 2 weeks ago or something like that. It's called The Whole Love. Now, Wilco is a band which I feel, I guess, a lot of punters out there are getting, I don't know, maybe a bit revisionist about. And it seems to be the cool thing to say that people are more into the experimental side of Wilco rather than the straight out ahead pop sounds, or heaven forbid that you should admit that you like AM, their country album. But I think I got into Wilco maybe just after AM came out. I think it might have been Dave O'Neill, while he was hosting the Triple R Breakfast Show. It was a big rap for him, so I followed up on their second album, and have basically been following them ever since, and they've produced some fantastic releases. And yes, I like the experimental stuff. Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, certainly probably the best album of that year, and yet a couple of albums back that they put out called Sky Blue Sky, I just absolutely adored. It was a very 70s, very summery guitar sounding album, and really heavy on melody, but I think a lot of people just sort of found it to be too much what they call easy listening, and I take objection to that. I think it was just a very strong pop album. So
this new record, where do you think?
Well, okay, well, so this is it. The new album, you put it on, and track one is called The Art of Almost. You put it on, and you think, right, if this is indicative of the rest of the album, we have an experimental album. It sounded, imagine the first time, if you're a Wilco fan out there, imagine the first time listening to Yankee Hotel Foxtrot and putting on the opening track, I'm Trying to Break Your Heart. Well, sort of like that, or maybe even more experimental than that, maybe closer to anything off A Ghost Is Born. It was, it certainly wasn't straight ahead pop. But after a couple of listens, I really got into it, and I thought, okay, that's a great tune. And then you're going further on, but as you sort of go further down the album, it really, I think, has more in common with the early stuff. Summer Teeth, I'd say Summer Teeth, which was album number three, very heavily poppy, and maybe even the last track on this album, Song for Jane Smiley's Boyfriend, I think. Sunday Morning. It sounds like it could have actually fitted in on the Billy Bragg Wilco Mermaid Avenue sessions. Very folky. So in a way, I'd say this album is sort of like a history of Wilco. You know, for those of you who like the experimental stuff, we've got a couple of tracks there for you. Those of you who like the poppy stuff, there's a song on it called Sunloathe, which is very Beatlesque. And there's one song in it called, I've forgotten the name of it. I should have the album with me. I should have something to refer to. Where are my notes? Lonesome, I think. Lonely, Lonesome. Anyway, feel free to write into me and let me know, although I've probably looked at the album cover before this goes to air anyway. But there's a... And in the cover notes, it says that there are samples on that track from the Stooges tune TVI. I can't hear it myself, but certainly the end of the song doesn't end in a way that the beginning of the song makes you think it will, and it does have a very Stooges-like ending. So they're really they're going all over the shop here, but I mean that is a good thing. Tweedy and Co. they've finally found a stable lineup after much of the internal dissension between Tweedy and Jay Bennett. For any of you who've watched the Wilco documentary film, I'm Trying to Break Your Heart, would have known that there was a lot of tension between the two more creative gentlemen of the group. And I don't know, I guess that turned me off Wilco as a group of personalities for a while, because certainly once Jay Bennett was kicked out of the group, the Knives came out from the hitherto silent majority of the group. But musically, they're definitely a band to be reckoned with, and certainly one of the finer bands in America. So check this one out. I'm just looking at my notes over here. Yeah, so that last song that I mentioned, One Sunday Morning, Song for Jane Smiley's Boyfriend, if I guess something to compare it to might be like side two of Neil Young's On the Beach record. So if you think you like that sort of acoustic-y style of Neil Young, then that's a 12-minute song, but not a minute is wasted, really. It's quite a great track and a fantastic album. So I've harped on long enough about that. I think another album I wanted to quickly mention is by Chris Difford, the he of the songwriting team Diven Tilbrook of the great band Squeeze. Now, did you ever see Glenn Tilbrook when he came out to Melbourne?
Yes, I have seen him once.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible talent. I haven't heard this new record, though, from Chris, so tell us about it. Is it like Squeeze?
A couple of tracks, yes. The thing is, during the years of Squeeze, it was often said that Tilbrook was the musical one and Difford was the lyricist. And in the absence of being with the other one, they've both had to acquire skills that the other one had. Although, having said, I think on this, which might be album number 3 or 4 for Chris Difford, I think this time he's found someone to write the music and he's stuck with the lyrics. Although in previous albums he has done music composition. Lyrically, it's interesting. He's getting, maybe nostalgic isn't the word, but there's a lot of looking back on this album. There's a lot of history. He's writing songs about being a father, but it's not dad rock. He's writing songs about his own youth. It's what I call melancholy pop. And there's the opener of the album is a song called 1975. And it, on the one hand, it might sound on the surface like it's being nostalgic, but this song, which sets the mood for a lot of the album, is like saying, yes, I remember when it was like back then, but it wasn't always for the better. And actually, I'm quite happy with my life right now. So it's not just, you know, gee, life sucks now, and wasn't it so much better back then? He acknowledges there were good things, but you know what? Guess what? I'm moving on with it. But he spends the whole album doing that. But if he were a lesser songwriter, it might just be self-indulgent pap, but he's fantastic. I mean, it wasn't for no reason that Diven and Tilbrook were the, you know, described as the Lennon McCartney of their day. Maybe it's overstating it a bit, but it gives you the point that they were, and still are, two extremely very talented songwriters.
So what's this album called?
This is called Cashmere If You Can. A very bad pun, but never mind. Another couple of highlights from the album. There's a song called Like I Did, where he's looking at his kids' activities and he's sort of thinking, oh, you know, geez, I can't really have a go at them for doing that because, you know, he's playing the bass like I did and he's smoking pot like I did and, you know, she's getting around like I did and all these sorts of things. I really want to stop them doing that, but, you know, shit, I made the same mistake, so I've got to let them make those same mistakes. Another song, Back in the Day, where he's talking about, you know, a different life that he had, and all these songs apparently are biographical, most of them are biographical. He's talking about, you know, his youth where he hung out in gangs and he, you know, the shame he feels, you know, he got into fights and did all sorts of things and took drugs and stuff that he claims nowadays he's not happy about, not proud of, but he's getting on with life. And real, this is, as I said, the theme for the album. It pays one song, pays tribute to his father in one song called Sydney Street, talking about his father coming back from World War II, how he'd had a hard time of it, and of course, you know, times were not easy in London or anywhere in Europe after the war, but somehow he managed to, you know, build a life and find a job and build up a family. And it all does sound very dad rock when I describe it, but being a dad and being of that vintage, I guess I think he's just an incredibly intelligent lyricist, and I look forward to the day where maybe he does a Stephen Cummings and turns his hand toward novel writing. I think he'd do a really good job. The lyrics on this album are just exquisite. I've been listening to a lot, but I think I'll call it there for the moment, talking about albums that we've been listening to. But I do want to mention a couple of other things. Recently, I guess I have been turning back to the music over the last couple of weeks of a guitarist who I absolutely loved since I was maybe about, I don't know, 9 or 10, a man called Bert Jansch, who unfortunately passed away. I think, what's the date today? Oh, yeah, maybe about 10 days ago or so. Bert Jansch was the guitar player, one of two guitar players for a great British folk pop group from England called Pentangle. But of course he'd had a guitar playing career before that and had one long after Pentangle ceased to exist. And actually about a month and a half ago, Pentangle had a reunion gig in London's Albert Hall, I think. So it might have been his last public appearance. but unfortunately Bert Jansch died of cancer-related difficulties. It's getting to be unfortunately hearing more stories like that, Jeff.
Yes, yeah, very, very sad news.
Originally he was from Glasgow. Pentangle were not a band. I mean, I guess I get lumped in the folk scene of London, as I've just done, but very different kettle of fish to a group like Fairport Convention, which had the wonderful Sandy Denny and Richard Thompson. Pentangle was a folk band that had jazz musicians and blues musicians in it, so they put their spin on the folk idiom. I urge you to go out and search out an album by Bert Jansch from 73-74 if you can, called LA Turnaround. It's got a song in it called Fresh as a Sweet Sunday Morning, and it's just one of the most beautiful melodies I think I've ever heard. Absolute gorgeous. The album's opening track, and I probably play it about 10 times before I get to the rest of the album. And if you want to search out a Pentangle album, go for Basket of Light. It's hard for words merely to describe something, but look them up. There'll be some footage on YouTube. Search out either of those albums, or there's a box set of Pentangle and a couple of good anthologies of Bert Jansch as well. And the other thing I want to mention is a great book I recently read. I found it about this through a podcast that's related to the English magazine The Word. Now, they have a fantastic podcast, and they recently interviewed biographical author Peter Doggett. He went and wrote this book called You Never Give Me Your Money, and it's another Beatles book, and Lord knows we've read probably lots of those, but the angle that this takes place, it actually starts fairly late in the Beatles' career, about the time where the Apple Company was starting up. Not the Steve Jobs Apple Company, the Beatles Apple Company, kids. There was an Apple before
Which
Steve Jobs.
Which didn't do quite as well as the Steve Jobs Company.
No. Well, it was... And this book sort of goes into some detail just as to why it didn't do so well. Apple started out originally as Paul McCartney and John Lennon's project to make sure that authors, filmmakers, musicians wouldn't have to, in their words, go down on bended knees to someone's office, probably yours, to get a project financed, and all sorts of parasites would come to their office and just take their money, and they ended up in all sorts of strife, all sorts of financial problems, and they were lost without the management skills, or at least management enthusiasm, of Brian Epstein. So they had all sorts of people come on board, and then the Beatles started hating each other, and all sorts of legal fracas. So this book sort of covers that legal fracas and really goes up to modern day. The Apple saga, the Beatles Apple saga, is a long and very sad story. Sort of takes the sheen, if you had this sort of superficial idea that, well, you know, it was sad in the end that they split up, but basically they were a group of guys who got along well. And certainly in the beginning they did, but this book just tells a lot about where it all went wrong. So I'd recommend that if you're a Beatles fan and certainly want to see something. It's not a seedy book, but it just sort of goes all out and tells, well, this is how it was and this is what happened. And for any of you, I guess it was an industry after John Lennon died of painting him as a saint, and this book, without getting into the nasty Albert Goldman style of writing, but it does sort of paint a very different picture, which I've also picked up from other Beatles books.
And does it mention a band called Grapefruit, who were one of the first bands to sign to Apple?
No, it doesn't, no.
And because I mentioned that because the Young Brothers, of course, Vander and Young, the Easy Beats, and then, of course, AC/DC, Malcolm and Angus, their older brother, Alex, who didn't actually come to Australia with the rest of them, he decided to stay in the UK. Right. He was in a band called Grapefruit,
wow,
one of the first bands to sign to Apple.
Yes.
So Apple signed Grapefruit. Unfortunately, they were a lemon.
I didn't know he was going to say that, folks.
Interesting footnote in the AC/DC, Easy Beats, Young Brothers
story. Who'd have thought there was a Beatles connection between AC/DC and the Beatles? But there you have it. All right, well, okay, enough of that. I guess we should be getting to the point of this week's show, which will be about the Knack, and we'll get on with that after the break. We'll be back in a minute.
When you're watching movies, are you sick of remakes, reboots, reimaginings, reinventions, and Reese Witherspoon? Are you fed up with movies where giant robots try to remake Enter the Dragon? Do you think that torture porn is vastly inferior to 1970s drive-in porn? Do you find Botoxed actresses with fake tits and action heroes with no chest hair a turn-off? Do movies where no single shot lasts more than 2.5 seconds piss you off? Yeah, me too. That's why I do Paleo Cinema Podcast, a podcast for films more than 20 years old. So if you think that Sid Charisse is a guy and that Myrna Loy is a kind of metal, you need Paleo Cinema Podcast. Go to paleo-cinema.com and do yourself a favour.
And we're back. Jeff over there, Morris over here. And yeah, we're going to be talking about the great album from 1979 featuring the musicians Doug Feiger, Burt Neveyor, Bruce Gary and Prescott Niles, aka The Knack, and their debut album in particular called Get The Knack. Before we start talking about the album exactly, let's talk a little bit about the history. You want to lead off, Jeff? Do you have anything to
say? Personally, I'm just so excited to be talking about this record because it is the first album I ever bought. And I know some people can often be embarrassed about first albums that they bought. I am not. I am so proud that my first album was Get The Knack. Mm. And as you said before, it is an underrated record. You know, it's been referred to as a guilty pleasure. I'm not guilty to admit that this album has given me so much pleasure over the years. And I think we're in furious agreement over this.
Absolutely.
Great title for an album. Great name for a band, The Knack. And then to have a debut album, Get The Knack. Just wonderful, wonderful stuff. An Aussie connection to this album, of course, the producer, Mike Chapman. Born in Queensland, started his music career in Australia, then relocated to the UK, had incredible success with The Sweet and Susie Quattro in particular.
And Blondie.
And then Blondie, which kind of led into The Knack, and then had more success with Blondie after doing the first two Knack albums. And the remarkable thing, and I think Mike Chapman really deserves credit for this record, and it's sort of a funny story, because his approach was just get it down on tape. Story goes, recorded in 11 days, cost only $17,000 to make, pretty much recorded live in the studio, one or two takes for every song. And Doug Feiger has said that you know, his approach was just tapes rolling and then great take. And that he even sort of would say to him, Doug, I'm stealing your money, because it was all so easy. That's being very flippant about it. There's incredible skill and genius in a record producer taking a band like The Knack and just going, these songs are great, you're a great band, let's just get it down. Other producers would have overproduced, they would have enforced themselves on this record and stuffed it up. Mike Chapman didn't do it. And there's incredible skill too. This is a great sounding record. Sure, it might sound live, but that's a beautiful thing about it. And you don't just get great drum sounds like this by accident.
No.
There is genius in Mike Chapman.
Mm. Do you know, actually, was Mike Chapman the band's choice or was he assigned to them by Capitol?
No, it was kind of a funny story, I think, in that the band had been trying to get a record deal for a long time and unsuccessful, but then finally got the record deal and then suddenly they were a real buzz band. And there was a story in maybe Billboard or in one of the papers in LA, and they were talking about the producers they'd like to work with, and they had kind of a list, a wish list. Mike Chapman wasn't on the list. He was in LA at the time, and he kind of took offense to this, and he was like, why aren't I on that list? So he contacted the label and said, why aren't I on that list? I should be on that list. I want to do this record. I don't know if he'd heard much or seen much of them, but he, you know, he knew they were a buzz band, and he thought, I want to work with them. He got the gig. And as I said, the beautiful thing about it, he didn't stuff it up. He just brought out the best in them as a great band.
An interesting story. I was watching the other night a documentary, which I think I might have sent you a copy of, called Getting the Knack. It was basically, you know, the story of the band from inception through to, you know, their unfortunate demise. Well, not quite to the demise, because, you know, well, Bruce Gary might have already died after this got released.
I think he sadly died in 2006.
Yeah. But yeah, the story goes, like I said, before the Knack, Doug had been playing in a band called Sky. No, not the John Williams, Kevin Peake, Tristan Fry Sky, but a band from Detroit, which I actually listened to, didn't think that much of. It was, I guess, typical 70s cock rock, maybe. But anyway, one of the songs that Sky, he'd written for Sky, or actually maybe it was the band after Sky, I'm not quite sure, but one of the songs he'd written in another life was a little thing called Good Girls Don't. And they had it in their live set, and Mike Chapman said, look, I want this on the album. And Doug said, look, no, look, we shopped this around years ago on a demo. Yeah,
they were on the demos, it got rejected by all the labels.
Don't want it. Capitol rejected them four times before actually taking them up. He said, and Chapman very wisely said, listen, Doug, record it once. If there's any problems with it, I won't ask you to do it again. And they played it, of course, perfect the first take. Mike Chapman, clever man, knew what he was doing.
Yeah, remarkable history, that song, because it was a true story.
Mm.
And it went back to 1966. And the girl from Doug's school, and he ended up at her house, and it was a true storyline.
I just sort of assumed it was all about Sharona. The whole album, I thought, was about Sharona.
No, I think there were a few different girls in there, and he ended up writing the song in 1972, so 6 years later. And then it was another 6 years before, you know, pretty much recording it. And as you said, they were over it by that point. He was just like, oh, I'm sick of this song. But yeah, another part of Mike Chapman's genius, he was like, let's do it. And what a, you know, a great line, good girls don't, but I do.
I remember in the documentary, Sherry Curry from The Runaways passes on her comment. She says, by the way, Doug, good girls do.
And of course, that was a really controversial song on the record.
Well, I remember listening all those years ago. I think it was a local radio station here in Melbourne. At the time, 3DB used to play, used to syndicate Casey Kasem's American Top 40. So I'd be listening every Sunday night. And when that song got to, I don't remember if it was number one, but it was certainly pretty high up.
I think it went to number 11 in America.
It was pretty high up. And I think they'd gone and changed the lyric from wishing you could get inside
her pants
to wishing she was giving you a chance, you know. Yeah, hang on, that's not the line. What are they doing? But of course, in Casey Kasem, so it really, in a way, that's the version to get. That's that'd be a bit of a rarity out there, I imagine. If you can find a copy of that 45 RPM, that's the one you want to get. That's pretty hard to obtain.
Because the thing about the Knack, which is an annoying thing, particularly in Australia, they're viewed as one-hit wonders. Because, yeah, technically, they did only have one hit single, Sharona. It was a monster.
Did Good Girls Don't chart here?
Didn't hit the top 40 in Australia. They did, of course, have three top 40 hits in the US. But in Australia, one-hit wonders. Even on Bert Newton's 20-to-1 TV show a few years ago, My Sharona, the Knack, they were the number one-hit wonders of all time, which, you know, it was great that they did have one hit, but I think, particularly in Australia, people are too easy to dismiss the Knack as one-hit wonders, because there was certainly much more to them than just that one song.
Let's talk a little bit about the musicians themselves. The band actually started, you know, Doug Feiger, from all reports, you know, was a very hungry sort of musician, and he was looking to find, you know, like players. And the first person he met was Bruce Gary, who was at the time a really well-respected LA session drummer. And Bruce could actually hear something in Doug's songs. He admired the material through him. And then Doug met up with Burton Avere, the guitar player. I'll get back to it in a minute. And then through Bruce met up, he brought from one of his old bands, Prescott Niles, to play bass in the band. Now, the thing, unfortunately, because once again, because the Get the Knack is sort of scoffed at so much, so no discussion has been made, the songs are often dismissed, so never mind, we can't even get onto a discussion of the musicianship itself. But I would argue that Bruce Gary is certainly one of the finest drummers to have appeared on a pop song in God knows how many years. And I was listening to another great podcast out there called Rock and Roll Geek, and the fellow there, I think he just basically, you know, he worshipped the ground that the Knack walked on, and he did a two-hour interview with Bert Nevers, the guitar player, and real. I think the host of Rock and Roll Geek was basically saying Bert Nevers is probably the finest guitar player he'd ever heard. So, you know, folks out there who might be listening to this, you might be scoffing, but you go back and you listen to, if all you're going to find is My Sharona, go back and listen to that guitar solo. It's melodic. It's well thought out. It's carved out. We should probably get more to that when we get to the songs themselves, but any comments on the musicianship?
Incredible. Particularly, you're a drummer, so I guess you would notice drummers more than maybe I would. But listening to the Knack, like the drums just constantly excite me in listening to it. I put Bruce Gary right up there, and another guy, and another band that people would scoff at, but an Australian band, Kings of the Sun. Incredible cock rock band. An amazing drummer, Clifford Hoad. I put Bruce Gary and Clifford Hoad together in that I notice them, and I just love it. It's such a thrilling listening experience, hearing these guys play the drums. They're fun, they're flashy. It's just incredible. It leaps out at you.
What I was going to say, Bruce Gary, his all-time drumming hero was Buddy Rich. And he basically wanted to take the approach that he wanted, basically from Buddy Rich, quote, "I want to overplay with style." And
he does it.
He pretty much does. But everything... Even though it sounds like he's all over the shop, and yet if you listen to live recordings, everything is completely reproducible. It's not like Keith Moon, and please don't take that the wrong way. Keith Moon was my hero, absolute drumming hero growing up. But there was probably a lot that Keith Moon wouldn't necessarily have reproduced, because it was all spur of the moment sort of stuff. Whereas everything Bruce Gary did. Was really well thought out, and yet it sounded as wild as Keith Moon. But all fine musicians.
One of the greats, and certainly as this band doesn't get the respect that they're due, certainly Bruce Gary, the late Bruce Gary, doesn't get the respect that he's due. A remarkable drummer.
Now, Jeff, you of all people should know, what was the final clincher in them getting their recording contract? What made the record company sit up and say, "Oh, we better sign these guys"?
You've got me there, Mo. You'll have to tell us that story.
Oh, you should know.
I have watched that doco, but not for a couple of years now.
Well,
so you'll have to refresh my memory.
When the Knack were playing along LA's Sunset Strip, I think of the Whiskey or Go-Go, famous venue there, they had many musicians in the industry coming to think, "Oh, we want to jam with these guys." And Tom Petty came and played with them, and Southside Johnny, I think, might have come and played with him, but Bruce Springsteen came and played. Jeff, they should have rolled off the tongue.
Yeah, and of course they did record "Don't Look Back," which I think was going to be on "Get the Knack," but didn't end up there. But did end up on a Springsteen tribute album, so it can be easily found now. The Knack doing "Don't Look Back," great Springsteen song.
Mm. So they played, I think, one evening with Springsteen, and then 2 days later they had something like 15
suddenly the labels wanted to sign it.
Sign with us, including the aforementioned Capitol Records, who eventually won them, who'd knocked them back four times before. But there you go. So you knock down hard enough, and you get the right people on the side. Who knows what you're capable of?
And certainly with Capitol, whether it was the band or whether it was the label, the whole, I guess, Beatles comparisons, and they really copped a lot of grief over, wanting to be, Beatles imitators, and how that impacted on the band. And it was probably, I don't know, whether a band being a little bit naive or whatever, because it is an incredibly dumb thing to, I guess, even subconsciously liken yourself to the Beatles. It'd be like a singer-songwriter coming out and saying himself, "I'm the new Dylan." Mm. It's not a smart thing to do.
And Lord knows, no one's ever done that before.
Well, usually you get tagged with it, but whether it was the band making mistakes there, they've copped a lot of heat unfairly.
I suspect that a lot of that new Beatles thing might have come from influences outside the band. Certainly Doug Feiger had a very healthy ego, but I mean, you listen musically to them, and really, I'm get the knack, I'd say, apart from That's What the Little Girls Do, I'd say there's nothing Beatlesque about the album. I'd say they had more in common maybe with early Kinks, early Stones, but it was an early Who than anything, and they weren't sort of like calling themselves the new Who, the new Stones, but
yeah, they got so much practice for a couple of photos more than the music, like you're saying.
Correct.
Which is ridiculous, but of course there was that enormous backlash, the Nuke the Knack.
Nuke the Knack. Look, it seemed like back in the time, and I do remember that everywhere you turned, you couldn't open a magazine, you couldn't turn on your television, couldn't open a newspaper without seeing a photo of the Knack and that front cover, that shit-eating grin of Doug Feiger's. So eventually the backlash was due to come, but there's been theories that either overexposure coupled with, I guess, journalists feeling somewhat miffed, somewhat put aside, because Knack management had gone and said to the band, don't do interviews, it creates a mystique, never do interviews. So at the time, I'm sure they did something, but not very much, and they probably put a lot of people offside. And I wonder whether your biographical subject, Mr. Meldrum, might have been put on side, because when it came to album number two, But the Little Girls Understand, which really, if Doug Feiger had his way, Get the Knack would have been a double album, including those songs.
Yeah, that was the plan, wasn't it?
It was.
Because all those songs existed.
Capitol didn't want to do that. Capitol said, no, it's a debut album, let's just keep it one album, we can come to those songs later. But Molly went and trashed album number two like it was, it's just more of the same. But
well, he wasn't alone there, but I think part of the problem, the Knack did come to Australia. It was a pretty quick sort of tour. It was when My Sharona was obviously massive. And I don't think they endeared themselves to a lot of people here. And I think that they were, it was that classic sort of case of they were exploding at home. And they're thinking, why are we so far from home? What are we doing here? We're just over it. We're tired, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I think, you know, they obviously met a number of people here, did a couple of gigs, and I don't think they were easy to work with. And so I think, you know, inevitably there is that backlash, like you were saying. The journalists are obviously annoyed. They don't get the interview. Those who do the interview and, you know, they don't get on very well. You know, it's human nature, unfortunately, that the backlash will follow. And which was kind of disappointing. Very similar story in lots of ways to, say, Men at Work, particularly the Men at Work story in America, in that the debut album, massive, the second album for Men at Work, Cargo, and it was called Cargo because they had all those songs already, and it was kind of, and it was, you know, reviewed as kind of a pale imitation of the first record. You're just repeating the same old tricks and all that sort of stuff. And of course, that's exactly what you were saying, that with the Knack, it was intended to be a double album. And also, the second album came along very, very quickly. It's remarkable to think Get the Knack came out in June 1979. The second album, But the Little Girls Understand, was February 1980. That's remarkable to think that, you know, the Knack, Get the Knack would have still been a huge album. Like what happened with Men at Work, Business as Usual was still in the top 10 when Cargo was released. So it's probably a victim of too much too soon.
Although back in the Beatles' day, and here's another Beatles comparison, back in the Beatles' day, it was not uncommon. They were releasing not only two albums of new material a year, but about four or five singles of non-album material.
Well, that's true. Over the course, and certainly Elton John was doing all that. A lot of artists were doing that. But I think by the end of the 70s and then into the 80s with Men at Work, the music industry had changed, and acts were tending to take much longer between albums. And I think it was, you know, Men at Work had a song called Overkill. It probably was overkill. People were still, you know, dealing with Get the Knack and all that. And then suddenly a second album appeared.
Yeah, but let's think about what some of those other albums that were coming out in the late 70s were. We're looking at albums by the likes of, you know, Fleetwood Mac, which would take 3 months just to get a good snare drum sound. I mean, you know, They'd be spending the like Eagles, 2 months. The Eagles, you know, they're just spending like a month just getting through their their cocaine stash. You know?
Exactly. I reckon though, and we can talk about this maybe another podcast. 1979 is the greatest year in music, and for me, like you were saying, with you know acts like Fleetwood Mac and the Eagles were around, so obviously that West Coast sound. But for me, it was the collision of so many things: the new wave thing, the punk was happening, obviously great rock was still happening, singer-songwriters, everything was going on in 1979, and the Knack were at the forefront of that.
Well, okay, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I happen to have here the week, the first week that My Sharona became a number one single in the US, here were the positions 2 through to 5, the top five.
They'll all be great songs. I haven't seen the list, but I can guarantee it.
Okay, good. Right. I'm glad you think that. Number one, My Sharona, of course. Number two, Good Times by Chic.
Yeah,
number,
well, because the whole three, disco thing was happening.
Number three, The Main Event by Barbra Streisand. Mm-hmm. Number four, After the Love Is Gone by Earth, Wind & Fire. Number five, Bad Girls by Donna Summer. So, all great songs, eh, Jeff?
That's something. It was a wonderful thing that, you know, disco was happening. As I said, the new wave thing, punk, everything was going on in 1979, and remarkable songs. That top five list, not the best list I've ever seen.
but maybe it might explain some reason why Get the Knack seemed like a breath of fresh air at the time.
I think that's true. And the reason, one of the reasons I talk about 1979 being the greatest year in music, apart from what I just said with the collision of so many things going on, was that speaking of Molly Meldrum, back in the TV Week days, I worked with him there. I went through every one of his columns from, I think it was like 1975 to, you know, 1990 or whatever it was, and wrote down all the songs that he wrote about. It was remarkable, the list of songs from 1979. There was just more. There was more of them. Mm. And there were just, so, you know, if you're talking about, say, you know, you could argue 20 great songs are released in a year or 30 great songs, it was double that in 1979. Do yourself a favor, go and check out a list of albums and songs that were released in 1979. It will astonish you. Lots of one-hit wonders too, but they were great hits.
All right. Well, we've gas-bagged for quite a while now about get Mr. Tongue and Mr. Lips together. We've talked for a while about the precedence, what led up to Get the Knack, and everything surrounding the album's release and the backlash and all that. So what of the album itself? Well, Jeff and I will speak about that after this coming break. We'll see you back in a minute.
American dream, Dusty Rhodes Davis. I'm coming to you live and in living color. Speak to you, the American people. A podcast called Silver and Gold Daddy. And you know that the American dream, Dusty Rhodes, knows how to bring home the gold, Daddy. And just like Henry Silver, sticking Bobby Boucher's head inside a sow hanging from the ceiling, Silver and Gold will stick it to you. Stick it to your ears. Stick it to your mouth, your eyes, your nose, Daddy. And all points in between, they'll take your listening pleasure and stick it between a sow's carcass hanging from the ceiling, Daddy.
Silver and Gold, we talk about movies and shit. Find us on iTunes or silverandgold.com.
And we're back. You're listening to Love That Album podcast. Morris here, Jeff there. And we've been discussing the great album from 1979 by the Knack. Get the Knack. It of My Sharona fame. But we're here to try and convince you that this album is an album of 12 great songs, not one great song. My Sharona, make no mistake, it's a classic single, fantastic single, but every other song on that album is an absolute pearler. And let's start out with side one, track one, which incidentally was the B-side for My Sharona. How good is this album where a song like Let Me Out is a B-side?
Yeah, obviously I'd heard My Sharona when I bought the album, very first album I ever bought, Get the Knack, and I was sold from Let Me Out. What a great opener. It just grabs you with that urgency and that pop intensity. It's just, and it sticks in your head, just that one line, Let Me Out. You might not have heard it in years, but you can remember just that incredible hook.
I guess maybe there was the other Beatles comparison, because like the Beatles' debut album, Please Please Me, with I Saw Her Standing There, opens up with Paul McCartney counting in 1, 2, 3, bah! And Doug Figer does the same thing there, so maybe they weren't doing themselves any favours. But it is a great opening.
Wonderful. And then, you know, goes into Your Number or Your Name. Great song. Bit of a change of pace with O Tara. But what, you know, that's a pop hit if ever I've heard one. Just great opener to the album.
I thought, talking about, so yeah, coming back to Let Me Out, it's a song that really requires a lot of muscular strength. I listened to that, like, it's just 2.5 minutes and it's got more energy, more spirit than 10,000 songs. I imagine if, you know, any lesser strong band were to get on stage, play that song, they'd be all knackered out, pun intended, after that 2.5 minutes, and think, right, we've done a whole night worth of energy in that one song. You'd be sweating.
And you've got 11 more great songs to go.
You do. And we were talking before about the incredible virtuosity of Bruce Gary, and really, I think, more than just about any other song on that album, that's really him doing his Buddy Rich Keith Moon impersonation on there. And the thing was, like, just as I said before, listening to live recordings, it was completely reproducible. Every note, it might sound like it's wild and all over the place, but he knew exactly what he was doing.
It's fantastic. An incredible opening cut, a statement of intent.
Certainly is. Your Number or Your Name, the next song, sounds, yeah, I guess this is a Beatlesque track. And that's definitely a positive thing, despite all the, you know, that, it's one thing to be dubbed the new Beatles, but certainly it is still okay to do Beatlesque material. And there've been plenty of bands which have gone and taken on a Beatlesque style of harmony or chord structure, and it's always been seen as a good thing. So, but all of a sudden the knack are being made to pay for it. Track number three, as you mentioned, O Tara, which I think Doug Figer said was about a roadie for a previous band. It might have been Sky, or I wish I could remember the name of the band he was in after Sky, but it might have been a roadie who he had the hots for. So there you go.
Because as you've written about, so much of this album is, you know, it's about lust and longing and adolescent lust. Mm. And it really, this, yeah, which so much great rock and roll is. But they copped a lot of grief too for supposedly being sexist.
Mm,
and it was such a negative thing. But as you point out, so many songs are about this subject and they don't cop the heat.
Well, no one ever claimed that Satisfaction was a bad song because it was about sex. And the thing was, Doug Figer at least had the honesty, the state of mind to be up front. I'm not going to couch this in double entendres. I'm going to say, I want you, let's do it now. And I heard another great statement made on the Rock and Roll Geek podcast, and they put forward the case that in fact Get the Knack is a concept album, and the main concept behind the story is blue balls. You know, this is not an album about sex. It's an album about not getting sex.
Wanting, you know, it, not getting it.
Figer was a horny teenager, and he wasn't getting all horny young 20-something. And then he met Sharona, and Sharona was, well, look, you know, I'm in love with my boyfriend, and you know, and you're with your girlfriend. What are you doing writing me this song? And just imagine the look on her boyfriend's face when Doug Figer was on stage singing My Sharona with his band, and she's in the arms of her boyfriend, and Doug Figer's on stage saying,
Also, imagine what Doug Figer's girlfriend would have thought of the song. Because, as you said, he wasn't hiding it. He could have couched it in other terms.
No.
He could have made up a name. But there was an incredible honesty to this record.
Well, the other side of that is track 4 on the album, which also features another great Bruce Gary drum beat, sort of a slowed-down Bo Diddley beat. The song's called She's So Selfish, and you think, oh, I wonder who he's writing this about. But in the documentary, Getting the Knack, Figer fesses up, it's about Sharona. So he was in lust with her, purely in love
and angry that she wasn't into him.
But she wasn't giving him any, so he writes this song, She's So Selfish. And apparently there's a clean version of that doing the round, so if you can find that, that's the rarity. The album has, you know, it was the language of the time. He was told, I think in the middle 8 bit, there was a lyric, no fucking me today. But, you know, and there were people said, oh, you can't do that, you can't say that. But Doug thought, you know, why? Teenagers say that. That's what we say. That's what we do. And he was just expressing his anguish. But, and yes, I guess he did come up for a lot of flack about it being sexist. But, you know, once again, a lot of sexist songs that just sort of were maybe a little bit more clever in hiding it in double entendre, but Figer made the cardinal sin of being open and honest about it. So there you go. But She's So Selfish, killer drum beat, and yeah, a racy lyric. Not, yeah, well, yeah, well, we'll leave it at that. Yeah, very racy lyric, and once again, full of energy, as every other song to that point does.
Because it has that wonderful nervous energy, the album. It's edgy.
It does. It does. Yeah, well, actually, remind me about Edge when we get to my Sharona. There's a point to make about that. Next song on the album, Maybe Tonight. This is the one point where the guys thought, right, we better slow down. We're running out of energy here, and they do a song called Maybe Tonight, which if you're not careful, you might be fooled into thinking that it's a love song, but really another lust song. You know, even lyric like, funny to think I have to clown and pretend you never knew I saw you as more than a friend. You know, the melody tells you it's a love song, but Figer tells you otherwise. You know, come on, I really want it. But a lovely moment. And I remember listening years ago to the 3XY. There's a Melbourne radio station that was big back in the day, folks. They broadcast live the Knack playing in Melbourne.
At Bombay Rock. The venue at the time.
And I remember being disappointed that they didn't do that song. They did, I think, maybe apart from that and Siamese Twins, they did every other song. Oh, and but That's What the Little Girls Do. But they did everything else from the album. I was disappointed because that was sort of a bit of a favourite of mine, that quieter ballad. But there you go, never mind. We got the album. And yeah, another a quiet song about lust, if that's possible. And then we end up with the last track of side one, which is Good Girls Don't. Have we said enough about Good Girls Don't?
We probably have. I just want to quickly point out the harmonica solo in that song. What a surprise that is when you first hear the song, but how well does it work within that song?
It is fantastic. Yeah, you think, oh, so Figer was going into a Bob Dylan phase. You should have been saying, oh, good girls don't, but I do. It could have worked. But yeah, it's just a little bit of flavour there, a little bit of
yeah, wonderful. Texture. And as I said before, just an incredible line: "Good girls don't, but I do." Mm. That's genius.
Then we back in the day when we had vinyl, we'd flip over the record. Side two, track one, the track of the moment, the one that even the grandmas knew. My Sharona. And we mentioned Edge. Figer mentioned he wanted something that was Who-like, and he blatantly admits he ripped off My Generation. He
wanted
that stuttering, with that stutter thing. I'm not sure whether he fell into any trouble about the song being anti-stutterist. I know that Townsend came in for some flack at the time, but maybe Figer did as well. I don't know. I might have to go back and watch Getting the Knack.
They were copping heat for everything, so I'm sure they did. But what I loved, you know, many things about My Sharona, but growing up in country Victoria, we all knew a Sharon. Sharon is such a great Aussie name. Mm. You know, Sharons are everywhere. Sharona, though, none of us had ever met a Sharona. We still haven't. The whole Sharona thing, just adding that A to the name Sharon.
It's actually Sharona. It's an Israeli name.
Okay, it was exotic. Mm. It was exotic. Australians had never heard that name, and that was exciting. Mm. So already this music, before we heard it, was taking us into another world, and then the music totally did as well.
Mm, mm.
Incredibly exciting, this song.
Burt Nevaire's guitar solo. As I mentioned before, the Rock and Roll Geek podcast, they would give me some promotion. I'm mentioning them a lot, but I think the host of the show was interviewing Burt Nevaire, and he played bits and pieces of the track, and when he got to that guitar solo, I think he was like in some sort of lustful ecstasy. So, oh man, I gotta play that again. That's the best guitar solo I ever heard. And, but it really is something to behold.
Yeah, the drums, the guitars, like there are just the riffs, there are just hooks all through this song, the vocal stuttering, the stop start sort of feel to it all.
But when you think about it, most songs have one riff, one killer riff. This has two. Yeah. Only one's being played on the guitar and one's being played on the drums. The moment you hear that drum beat, you can't start it off any other way. That's that drum riff.
Yeah.
You hear it and you know what's coming up. And then boom, 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 boom. It's fantastic.
It's, if you had to play one perfect pop rock song to someone, pick My Sharona.
We're going to put it into a pod. Send it out into space, Jeff, I reckon.
Oh, we should do it.
NASA should have already done this.
It's got everything. And the pleading and the desperation in the lyric, the lust in the lyric, it's phenomenal. Mm. You cannot fault this song.
Mm. And then we come to the album's sole cover. I know that Figer had a healthy respect for rock and roll history. I guess he was a guy who had his own songs he had to prove, but they still had a healthy respect for rock and roll history, and so they launch into a knackified version of Buddy Holly's great song Heartbeat. Now, the original Buddy Holly version is sort of done in a very gentle, very Latin-y sort of way. You can imagine sitting by the pool with a margarita in one hand and just sitting there enjoying the sunshine, but this is another song of lust, Heartbeat. Why do you skip when my baby kisses me? This is, once again, he's turned a love song into a lust song.
Really inspired cover.
Mm. The next song on the album. Now, this is one I, for a long time, this is probably, well, even this, it does have a lust connection, though I never really knew about it. Burt Nevaire told the story that, in fact, he was a big fan of an American author called John Barth, B-A-R-T-H, and he'd written a book of short stories, I think called Stories from the Funhouse. It's definitely got something from the Funhouse is a title. And there was a story in it, I think called Petition, and it was told about a fellow who had a Siamese twin, but this twin was on his back. And no matter what this guy tried to do, if he was making love to a beautiful woman, the little guy on his back was always breathing into his ear, "No, I want her, I want her, I want her." And you know, Burt Nevaire introduced this short story to Doug Figer, and he instantly became a fan of John Barth's work. And then the two of them came up with this song, but from the perspective of the bigger twin, the guy, you know, who sings, and he's on my back, he's driving me crazy, kill him, throw him out on the road somewhere, I'm trying to make it with this girl over here, and he's just on my back.
Which again, that sort of fun and playful nature of that song comes through in the music. It's just a really fun beat to that song.
It does. Three songs left. Oh my god. And then we have to go back to side one again. I'm having so much fun. Lucinda. Now, I haven't seen anything in the docos that says who Lucinda actually was.
No.
Maybe it's a nom de plume for Sharona again, but I guess this is a song that's a slower song, slower ballady song, but it's the mood is sort of more in the vein of She's So Selfish. You know, Lucinda will bring you down. Lucinda's going to make you cry. Once again, poor Douglas Feiger is complaining about not getting any and Lucinda ain't going to give it to him. He's not having much luck with the ladies.
No.
Old Douglas Feiger, but he brought it upon himself.
And again, being a little Aussie bogan at the time, you know, I knew a Sharon, but I didn't know any Sharonas. You knew a lot of Lucy's, but Lucinda was an exotic name too.
And now you're a big fan of a Lucinda, aren't you?
Exactly.
Lucinda Williams?
Yes, indeed. So this Get the Knack opened my eyes in so many ways.
Mm. That's what the little girls do.
Yeah, the pop hooks in this song, incredible.
Yeah, this is a Beatlesque song. The harmonies are there, ooh la la la. There's all over the place. I guess not too much. This is, I guess, more of a filler song, but you know, the Knack doing filler was, you know, other people's number one pop hit. But yeah, this is a pop hit, less on the aggression. Once again, you know, Douglas Feiger thinking that he's being hard done by, it's got a beautiful pop melody and those great pop harmonies that still make it worthy of your attention. But this is all a distraction from the final song on the album, Frustrated.
Because if, as you said, it is a concept album about not getting any
blue
this
balls.
One, this, you know, is the full stop on that. It's just, hey, it hasn't worked out. Frustrated.
Mm. He's just not getting any satisfaction. I wonder if Mika heard this album. I wonder if he wanted to sue Feiger. Oh, you stole all my songwriting ideas. I guess, look, I don't know, I'm going to say the final point, but I'll probably think of something else I want to say about this. But it seems incredible to me that Get the Knack has been so derided over the years. I'm not saying by everyone, because I know that there are people out there doing my searching over the net. There are other people who do feel like we do. And certainly there are other musicians who feel like we do. But, you know, the general thing, I mean, I've been to other people's places, I've been to parties, I'm talking about music, I say, I love Get the Knack, and they'll say, oh, well, we'll be praying for your soul, or something like that. Like,
yeah, or they think it's one song.
They think it's the one song. And yet, I mean, really, Nirvana, Nevermind, Smells Like Teen Spirit, big hit. Was there another really big hit? I mean, really big hit.
Well, and yeah, and certainly that album is not seen as a one-hit wonder album.
No,
it's seen
not.
As a great album, which this one should be too. And this, it's one of the greatest debut albums ever.
Mm.
It's one of the greatest rock records ever.
For sure.
But certainly a remarkable, you know, to think that this is a debut album. It's just phenomenal.
So after Get the Knack, they went on to make the aforementioned But the Little Girls Understand, which was really, I guess, Get the Knack part two, but that was what Doug Feiger had intended. But yeah, some great songs on that. Baby Talks Dirty, which was the lead-off single from that album, I guess that might have come in for some flack, because that had a riff that was too much like My Sharona. I guess that could be guilty of, and if My Sharona hadn't existed, maybe Baby Talks Dirty might have been a lot bigger than what it was.
Yeah, it was probably a dumb first single in hindsight, because it left themselves wide open for the critics just to jump in and go, oh, they're just, you know, repeating their old tricks.
Mm.
It's a rewrite, you know. And they were saying the entire album was a rewrite of the first album. But as we pointed out, it was originally intended to be part of that first album. Doug wanted it to be a double album. Yeah, probably an unfairly overlooked second record, because I don't think the critics even wanted to listen to that record. They were just out to bag the Knack.
Now, I think I've seen on Amazon in recent weeks that later on this week, well, of course, depending when you're listening to this podcast, but as of late October, there's going to be a new remaster of Get the Knack. Unfortunately, not with the bonus tracks that came out on the last remaster. But if you don't already have this album, and hopefully we've convinced you by now that you ought to search it out, go to YouTube. You'll see the My Sharona film clip, but people have gone and put up all the songs in one form or another.
And of course it is.
On YouTube, if you need convincing, if we haven't already done it.
It is very sad too. Doug Feiger died in 2010. We'd already said goodbye to Bruce Gary in 2006. Mm. In Australia, we were very lucky to get to see Doug Feiger. I think it was 28 years after the Knack were here. He came and did the Countdown Spectacular Tour. And of course, only got to do a couple of songs, but it was wonderful to see him live. on that tour. And yeah, my final words, if this album hadn't sold 6 million copies, it would be revered. It is a victim of its own success.
Yes.
It is a wonderful record. Whether it sold squillions or sold nothing, it is just a great record.
Another one, if you want to follow this up with another Knack record, if you sort of come to your senses and realise that Knack really is worthy of the majesty that we're presenting it with, I think their last album, or maybe second last album that they put out in the early 2000s, was an album called Zoom. They had a reformation. They'd split up, of course, I think in New Year's Eve, 81 going on to 82. Got back together a few years later with the original lineup, but Bruce Gary and Doug Feiger they didn't like each other, I think, to put it mildly. Guitar player and drummer hating each other's guts, and we'll talk about that on another band in a future podcast, but it's a common thing, it seems. But so they went on with a succession of other drummers, I guess, just like Spinal Tap. And one of those drummers was Terry Bozzio, another respected session drummer, and they put out another really great pop album called Zoom. So if you can track that one down, I think it might even be on Rhino Records. It's well worth your while. But if you don't do anything else, don't get Zoom, just get the Knack.
Exactly. It's not a one-hit wonder album. It's a 12-hit wonder.
Exactly. Well, there you go. We've gone and gaffled on about the Knack for quite a fair bit of time now. So hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you've enjoyed this podcast. And we'll listen to the couple of back episodes and maybe stay tuned for in a couple of weeks for the next episode. Jeff, any projects, anything that you want to promote, anything that's happening? What's happening with you in the next few weeks?
No, but
website, any of you who happen to be in Melbourne should pick up a copy of Impress, the weekly street magazine, that music magazine that Jeff writes an excellent column for called How's That?
An Australian music column.
Yes, all Australian music. Jeff is a great champion of not just Australian music, but underrepresented Australian music. So I urge you to go search that out. And of course, when he gets any other projects up, Love That Album will be, if not the first, will be one of the first to make you aware of what
Thanks,
projects
Brian. I'll have to do something.
Good.
I've got something to talk about.
Oh, hurrah.
But let's do another podcast soon.
We will, absolutely. Any of you out there who want to get in touch with me, you can send me an email at rrrkitchen, that's all one word, rrrkitchen@yahoo.com.au. You can find the podcast either by going to my blog site, Love That Album, that's all one word, lovethatalbum.blogspot.com, where I have also a series of articles that I write about my favourite albums, although I've been a bit negligent about that in recent weeks. Or if you go to your iTunes search engine, type in all one word, Love That Album, and you can get it that way. Spread the word amongst your music-loving friends. I'd like to get as many people listening to this as possible for the obvious reasons. Really, if you have any thoughts about this podcast, if you have anything you want to let me know, even if you write in and say, look, I think Get the Knack is a shit album, I'll severely disagree with you, but I'll be very interested in hearing why you think so. So anyway, until the next podcast, this is Morris and Jeff signing off, and I hope I'll be able to convince you to come on the show again real soon.
Love to, Mo.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Cheers, guys.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any fantasy points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.